A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 26. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television. And today we are continuing our discussion of Gormenghast. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. As we discussed in the last episode, Gormenghast, 2000 BBC miniseries, adaptation of the first two novels by Mervyn Peake. The story that we've been discussing sort of continues with Steerpike rising up through the ranks of servitude, I suppose, to the family of Groan in Gormenghast. And he manages to manipulate his way in with the two sisters, Clarice and Cora, who, as we've said, they're simple-minded characters who really just want more power for themselves. And in particular, they want the trappings of power. They want their carriages and they want thrones and they want servants, that sort of thing. He manages to manipulate them to help him get what he wants. And part of that is the destruction of the Earl's library. Because, as we said, the Earl, the 76th Earl of Gormenghast, is fanatical about his books and his histories and his poets, one of the few things he gets excited about. So that when his library is destroyed, it basically, not to give too much away, but it starts to send the Earl quite mad.
It certainly had some very strong moments and powerful moments where the library goes up in flames, and the impact from that seems to impact everyone, and especially Lord Groan, who, once this tragedy has happened to him, basically begins to lose his sanity and goes through terrible things. And this sense of intensity of what Steerpike is doing and what he is causing just builds.
Absolutely. And as you say, he just propels events on. Because it's a very dramatic scene, a very dramatic sequence with the library burning. And as you say, some of the consequences for the Earl are very unpleasant. And also for the sisters, Clarice and Cora, who, rather than getting the thrones and the trappings that they want and that Steerpike promises them, in fact, it seems to drive them further and further away from the rest of the family, and they become more and more isolated. And I think their behaviour becomes more bizarre as well. And so there's really quite a lot going on there with them. And they are entertaining, but as we've said, they're also very tragic characters, and things don't go very well for them either.
And it highlights just how bad Steerpike is, just how manipulative he is, and just how willing he is to completely ruin someone's life and just leave them in these awful, awful situations to further his own goals for himself.
He absolutely takes advantage of the sisters, doesn't he?
Oh, definitely. And there's a sense that not only is this for his own means, to his own ends, it's something that he enjoys. He enjoys exerting power over people. He enjoys proving to himself that he's smarter than other people. He enjoys causing suffering and exerting power over people. And as things continue and we see these very dark elements with Steerpike and the library and the sisters and so on, we also see Titus growing up. Titus as a boy, as about maybe a 12-year-old and so on. And we see the education of Titus, and he's learning the general things, the general education that all children in Gormenghast would learn, and also learning about his own responsibilities. We see the rituals becoming more intense. The rituals haven't changed, but the way we're seeing them as they're portrayed is very restrictive and intense. And to Titus, the constant ritualism and ceremonies and all these things that he has to be involved with are extremely restrictive, and they just hold him down. That's something that really develops and progresses with this, is the sense of what the ritualism is like and how Titus deals with it.
While Titus is rebelling against that, we see Steerpike, who quite likes the ritual and tradition, and it sort of appeals to his dramatic, theatrical nature in a way. Plus, as you say, this constant theme of his, which is proving how much cleverer he is than everybody else.
Yes, and the ritualism is like a tool for him. He can learn about that and take advantage of it in order to further his own ends and express his own power.
Yeah. And you've mentioned his education, the education of Titus, which brings us to the teachers and the professors. Because as we've said before, this is the story of Gormenghast is moving along towards a very dramatic conclusion. As you can probably guess, a big confrontation is coming. But before we get there, we do get some comic relief. And in particular, we get it from the teachers at the school and also from the character of Irma Prunesqualler, the doctor's sister, who decides that she is extremely attractive and that she must have a man, and basically persuades her brother to throw a party and to invite all the eligible men, which just about seems to be all the teachers from the school, including Professor Belgrove, who you've mentioned before, who's played by Stephen Fry. And in fact, I think all the professors and teachers at the school are played by... they're just about all the British comedians of the last sort of 10 or 15 years. Every British comedian you can think of, you know, the Fast Show and the League of Gentlemen, are playing one of the teachers.
And Stephen Fry does a great job in that role as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Stephen Fry's hilarious when he turns up. And also, I mean, before he becomes the head of the school, the sort of the outgoing head of the school is played very briefly by Spike Milligan, bless him, in probably his last ever appearance before he died, who gets a notable, literally a wheel-on part in a wheelchair.
So as you can see, we have quite a cast here with people like Christopher Lee and Spike Milligan and Stephen Fry just filling in some of the minor to moderate characters.
Absolutely. Everybody's in it. You know, there's recognizable faces and names all the way through this. And it was just this huge sort of, you know, list of characters that Mervyn Peake created who are filled out on screen. And then we've also, as well as the comic relief, we also get the continuing battle going on between Flay and Swelter, the Earl's manservant and the sort of the master chef of the kitchens, who have this obviously deep-seated hatred of each other. And the battle between them just continues. They're plotting against each other.
That was pretty dark and pretty intense for those actors and the characters.
Yes, it's grim stuff. You know, they really do hate each other.
And I think as much as we'll say on that is that it does not end well.
No, it doesn't seem like it's going to end well.
And as things progress, and this is getting well into the story here, Gertrude, the lady of the house, and Prunesqualler, the doctor and advisor, start to grow suspicious and start to see there's something not quite right and something is going wrong. And gradually they become suspicious of Steerpike. Steerpike covers his tracks and makes himself seem innocent very well. But over time, and the whole story takes something like 17 or 18 years, over that span of time, they gradually become suspicious of what's going on with Steerpike, that he may be behind some things.
And that's, you know, I think it's very interesting character development. As we've said, Prunesqualler is certainly more intelligent than he initially appears. And Lady Gertrude, I mean, when we first meet her, she's this rather grotesque character in her room full of animals, and she's not at all interested in other humans, really, at all.
Except perhaps to bully them.
Yeah, except to bully them and shout at them, exactly, yes. But as events progress and sort of unpleasant things start happening, she has to take on a much more dominant role, and her suspicions are growing as well. And I think that's very well done by Celia Imrie and by John Sessions.
Yes, it was very well done. There were a number of characters in Gormenghast who were played both for humor and for things that were very serious. And all of these actors were able to pull that off very well. It was kind of impressive.
Come closer. What's the matter with you, boy? I said closer. I want to talk to you.
You never have before.
Well, I do now. You're 17, Titus. How are you, my friend? It's about time you grew out of this sulk.
Are you talking to me or the bird?
You. That's yours. It's yours by inheritance and right. You can't give it away. It's yours forever, whether you want it or not.
Thank you, Mother.
What more do you want, boy? There isn't anything else I can give you, and if there was, I wouldn't.
I've understood that much.
Ah, go up, boy! You are no ordinary son, and you have no ordinary mother. Look. Turn. Look. Look at it. And learn to love it for what it is. You can't love anyone or anything else. Because there isn't anything else. There is only your duty to those who love you. Think, Titus, and grow. Soon, perhaps, we will all need you.
We should also talk about Mervyn Peake, who wrote the original novels that Gorman Gast was based on. As you may have gathered, we are pretty impressed with the work he put into it and the characters and all the references that he's developed here. Mervyn Peake was born in China, actually, the son of medical missionaries. He was born in 1911. He did actually go back to England, I believe when he was still quite young, and worked as an artist. He was at the Royal Academy Art School in Croydon, studying there. And he exhibited artwork and did illustrations for children's books. He was really quite active as an artist. There was at least one major edition of the Brothers Grimm fairy tales that had his illustrations in it. And the original illustrations that were first published with Alice in Wonderland were Mervyn Peake's illustrations. So if you're thinking, I know this name, Mervyn Peake, but it's not as an author, or it's not from Gorman Gast, it well may be that if you had a copy of Alice in Wonderland with old-style illustrations, that those were the Mervyn Peake illustrations. They're quite widely used for that. He was also a war artist. That, I believe, was something that did not last very long for him, painting war scenes and things, because he actually had a nervous breakdown and went on to other things.
And what he went on to when he recovered from his nervous breakdown after the Second World War was the first of the books. So he publishes his first book in 1946, which is Titus Groan, first volume in the Gorman Gast trilogy. And as you've already said, Brian, Titus Groan begins more or less, or very early on in the book, we have the birth of Titus. But by the end of the book, we'll only have got Titus to about his first birthday, because the book is really setting the scene of Gorman Gast and what goes on in the castle and the traditions and all these other fantastical characters we've been talking about. And of course, Steerpike's slow, you know, his initial steps on the ladder to power. So that's the first book, Titus Groan. And then I think 4 years later, I believe, 1950, he brings out Gorman Gast, the second book, which is going to take Titus from the age of one up until the age of 17 and cover pretty much what we've been talking about, I suppose, in the second 2 hour episodes out of the four that we've been talking about in this mini-series.
And it's that second book that brings the focus more from Steerpike gradually over to Titus. Because at the beginning, Titus was an infant, and it was really about Steerpike. And in that second book, you really start bringing the focus more from Steerpike over to Titus.
Yeah. And I mean, I think also, as you say, there's certainly a lot of Peake's earlier experiences go into the writing of those first two books. You know, his experiences as a war artist and his nervous breakdown. And there is some stuff about the darkness of war. And certainly there's a very famous quote by Anthony Burgess about the books, which says they are all about war in the early 20th century.
Some people do consider them a commentary of sorts on both the First and Second World War.
But as we said, there's also all this other stuff in there as well about class structures and traditions, and there's a fantastic amount of stuff in there. And the description of all the characters and the scenes and settings is quite remarkable. And that's, I mean, I think why the books are still so popular. There was another short story published after that, which was 1956. He published a short story or a novella called A Boy in Darkness, which is basically about Titus Groan, but I don't think he's ever named in the book. It seems to be clearly that it is Titus who is the character who seems to escape from Gorman Gast for a short while into a mysterious adventure. And I think that was published in a collection of short stories of his. And that's 1956.
And then in 1959, Titus Alone, the third book in the trilogy, which was not covered in the TV miniseries, Titus Alone was published in 1959. And by this time, in the late 50s, Mervyn Peake had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, and it was significantly limiting what he could do with his writing. So Titus Alone was really the last major work that was completed by Peake, and it in some ways may have not entirely been completed by him. the last draft that he wrote was not as complete and not as fully revised as he normally would have done. And I understand the publishers did a fair bit of editing onto that to get it into a publishable form more than they normally would have. And in fact, years later in 1970, Langdon Jones re-edited Titus Alone, basically to correct problems with poor editing by the publishing company from the 1950s. And that brought it more to something like what Peake might have had when he really completed it as he would have liked to.
And Titus Alone is interesting because it's quite a different type of story to the first two books. Titus travels into the outside world away from Gormenghast and encounters a strange city where they've never heard of Gormenghast. And not only have they never heard of Gormenghast, but they seem to have a level of technology beyond that in the first two books. So it's quite different in tone, I think, to the first two.
Yes, it certainly was known for having a different feel to it and a strange way to end a trilogy. And there's a reason for that, because Peake intended to write more books in the Gormenghast series. There was a tradition that he had intended to follow of covering your central character from birth until death. And he certainly started with Titus Groan at the birth of Titus, and he intended to continue after Titus Alone until the death of Titus. So Titus Alone would be more of a middle volume of Titus's wandering before he would return to Gormenghast to continue his life as ruler there. And he actually wrote about 3 pages of Titus Awakes, which was intended to be the next volume, and I believe there was meant to be at least one more book after Titus Awakes. So there was some interesting potential there, and there is not that much known about what he would have done with it. He had some notes written down, I believe, but not very much. The 3 pages that he wrote of Titus Awakes are included in the 1995 edition of the Complete Gormenghast trilogy in one volume. And there is very little known beyond what he would have done after those 3 pages and where he would have gone from there.
Who knows? It would have been fascinating to find out what happened to Titus and Gormenghast.
It would have been, but he certainly had a pretty fantastic base of work from the 3 that he did complete.
So sadly, Mervyn Peake died in 1968, and I think certainly in the 1970s, the books became even more popular, possibly due to, as you say, new editions with some of the editing problems cleared up. They were so popular that I think it was inevitable that there would be adaptations of the stories. So there were some other adaptations apart from this BBC miniseries. And we think that the first one would have been a 1983 Australian radio broadcast of the story. But we don't know much more about it than that, other than that they may have been the first out of the gate.
Yeah, there isn't a lot of information about that. There's a little bit more about the 1984 BBC radio version, which actually had Sting as Steerpike. I haven't heard this, but I think it would be an interesting listen to hear that. It was originally done as 2 90-minute radio plays broadcast in 84. And then much later, it was edited down, I think about 20 minutes shorter, as one long show that was aired many years later, I think in the 1990s.
Yeah, I heard some of it at the time. Sting was and still is a huge Mervyn Peake fan, and I think he'd pushed quite hard to get a role in the radio adaptation on the BBC. So that was 1984. There were some other works of Mervyn Peake that were adapted for television. There was a story of his called Mr. Pye, that's P-Y-E, Mr. Pye, and that was adapted by Channel 4 television here in Britain in 1986 into a mini-series starring Derek Jacobi, famously from I, Claudius, but he's been in lots of other things, including having recently played the Master in Doctor Who. And that's a sort of religious allegorical tale about a character who lives on one of the Channel Isles, the Isle of Sark, which is an interesting place because it was reputedly the last feudal state in Europe. And that's Sark. So in it, Mr. Pye, when he's good, he gets angelic features. So basically he grows angel's wings when he's good. And when he's bad, he gets sort of more demonic or devilish features develop. And I remember watching that in 1986. I think partly because I was interested in the Isle of Sark.
That sounds like an interesting one. I have not seen that. It sounds like an interesting role for Derek Jacobi. I'm sure he could have pulled that off.
Well, I mean, Derek Jacobi's always watchable, and I do remember, I mean, as I say, I haven't seen it since 1986, but I do remember it being interesting, and Derek Jacobi walking around with angel's wings.
I'm sure that would have been quite something. There were also some stage productions of Gormenghast. In particular, in 1993, there was a walking production by a youth theatre in Canberra, Australia. And they did something where they had several outdoor areas and indoor locations, and the cast would walk from one location to another, and the audience would follow behind them and go to the next location to continue watching the play. There was also, much more recently, in 2006 and 2007, there was a version that toured the UK, and it apparently was quite minimalist, focusing on a couple of actors and then having other things play in with that, and it apparently had a lot of mime components. So that could have been an interesting one as well.
Okay. And then in 2000, the BBC also did an adaptation of the story The Boy in Darkness, and they made a 30-minute sort of short film, which it sounds quite interesting. I've never seen it, and I would quite like to see this, because I haven't actually read that story, and it's supposed to be quite scary. I think they used computer graphics for the setting, and they set it in a sort of virtual world, and the character of the boy, who's supposed to be Titus Groan, was played by one of the EastEnders actors, an actor called Jack Ryder. But the story was narrated by Terry Jones of Monty Python fame. So that sounds like it quite interesting, and I'd perhaps like to track that down.
Yes, that would be an interesting one as well. Gormenghast has a reputation for being quite difficult to adapt. You'll notice we were talking about it becoming more popular in the 70s and revised editions in 1970 and so on. And it wasn't until 83, 84 that people were adapting it even on radio, because it, as I say, was known as being very challenging to adapt. It was considered very ambitious when the BBC did this TV version in 2000. It had been considered for a film adaptation on at least one occasion. I know Terry Gilliam, also of Monty Python fame and director of many other films, was looking at doing a version of Gormenghast. That fell through, in part because it is such an ambitious thing to do, and trying to do that for film would have been very difficult.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, it was sort of famously thought to be impossible to adapt, but I think the BBC in 2000, possibly when the technology had caught up, but in 2000 the BBC showed that it could be done on the screen, and probably best done on the small screen in the miniseries format, and they were very successful.
So many stories, fantasy and science fiction and other things, have been considered unfilmable and then have been filmed and done very well. Lord of the Rings comes to mind.
Absolutely, yes. If you don't know Mervyn Peake and Gormenghast, the books had the same sort of reputation and following as the Lord of the Rings books. They were hugely popular and still are.
Yes, they don't have the same international popularity as Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's other work has. But in the UK, they certainly have that kind of popularity. And many people studying and reviewing fantasy and these types of fictions from that period of time, from the 40s and 50s, do make that comparison and look at those two as having definite similarities. They are similar in length, actually. The two of them are around the same length. I think Gormenghast may be a somewhat more difficult read. I'm not sure about that.
So we should talk about the good parts and the bad parts of the BBC adaptation, and what we liked and perhaps didn't like quite so much. Do you want to start on this one, Brian?
There's a lot to say here. The performances were great. I have very few complaints about performances. The situations where you had one or two actors that were not necessarily great actors, they were well cast. It worked well. You had a number of these older actors who were very good, like having people like Christopher Lee and Richard Griffiths in there. You had the comic actors like Spike Milligan and Stephen Fry and John Sessions able to pull these kinds of things off. You also had Jonathan Rhys-Meyers doing this quite powerful performance as Steerpike.
Yes, I mean, it's a very dramatic theatrical performance. There may be a slight problem in that I think in the books, Steerpike is a far more ugly and physically unattractive character than Jonathan Rhys-Meyers, who, of course, is very good-looking and looks very well-dressed when he starts to rise to power in this adaptation. And I must admit, the first time I watched it, I wasn't quite sure about Jonathan Rhys-Meyers. But having watched it again, actually, I liked his performance much more the second time. And I felt it worked pretty much perfectly. I think he has a lot to contend with, because as you say, he's only 23 when he's making this. And he's up against the absolute Premier League of British character actors. But he does hold his own.
And playing this complex, multi-layered, evil character as well.
Yeah, but I mean, as you say, the performances are absolutely one of the outstanding things about this adaptation, because the field is just several people deep. There's so many fabulous actors and fabulous characters. It's just great, really. I mean, we've mentioned some of them along the way. Zoe Wanamaker and Lindsay Baxter playing the twins are just fantastic. The job they did to mimic each other's actions and speech was amazing. Celia Imrie as Lady Gertrude, who just becomes more and more powerful and important as the story progresses. Although, actually, I mean, she never becomes likable. She's quite an unpleasant character, but she really has this sort of nobility and responsibility about her, which becomes more important.
This is not a story that's known for likable characters.
There's not many of them, are there? Not many likable characters in here, but they're all fantastically watchable.
Yes. If you are someone who feels that you need to have a good person as a protagonist, or you need to have someone to really sympathize with, it's a little tricky for this one, because you do have so many very watchable and interesting characters, but they don't tend to be likable for the most part.
No, it is difficult to like them, because even Titus has problems in his character that lead us to not be quite so sure about him as the story progresses. While we're talking about the actors, I do want to mention a couple of other of the minor characters, just because if you've watched British television, it's fantastic to see the minor characters turning up. I'll mention a few names if you know British television, like Eric Sykes is in there. Warren Mitchell plays Barkentine. June Brown is in there. And for me, absolutely fantastic to see Windsor Davis as the Captain of the Guard. Just, you know, if you've ever seen a program called It Ain't Half Hot, Mal, you'll know Windsor Davis. I just loved seeing them when they cropped up. It's fantastic.
Yeah, there's some great stuff in here for sure. To look at the things that we're not as convinced on, that we didn't like as much, I found some of the comic portions, particularly in episode 3, were a little weak. They were done well, but after going through this high-paced dramatic story, having the sort of comic sequences of characters courting and things like this didn't quite seem to fit, and that wasn't what I was interested in seeing. It was well done, but it only worked so-so in the context, I thought.
Yes, I mean, it's episode 3 out of this 4 episodes, and episode 3 is the comedy one, isn't it?
Yes.
It seems to devote it entirely to the comic relief, and as you say, it would perhaps have been better if that could have been interspersed a bit more throughout the story, and it's such a solid block of it in the third episode that it does feel slightly jarring, and we want to get back to the rest of the story.
Yes, some of what they did in there with the comic stuff was good, but some of it was just a little much.
Yeah, there's perhaps too much of it in there, but they obviously felt they wanted some comedy relief. And of course, you know, Irma Prune Squalor's romance with the teachers is straight from the book, but it does, there is quite a lot of it in the third episode, isn't there?
Yes.
There were also, I think, there were some criticisms that the design and the sets may have been too light and bright compared with the descriptions from the book, because the books, I think, it's very dark and gothic, and Peake's illustrations are very dark.
Yeah, this had colour.
Yes, exactly. I think this has colour and it has light. And I think, you know, for BBC, they had to brighten things up a bit to make it visually arresting, which, of course, with the models shot in water and oil or however they did it, is just absolutely amazing. amazing, but it is quite bright in a way compared to the source material.
Yes, the points where this adaptation varied the most from the original novels, probably the biggest things were the look and the sort of brightness and the feel of things having that look to them, and the nature of Steerpike being a little more attractive and charismatic in a different way.
Yeah. But we've said, you know, strong performances, great sets, great costumes, the music is fantastic. It's really, you know, there's an awful lot to recommend it here.
Yes, I quite agree. It's a very entertaining show, and I always enjoy watching it.
Yeah. I mean, does it fit into our genre in a way? Do you think it is science fiction, or does it fit more into the fantasy sort of part of it?
This is something that with the Gormenghast novels, people have been discussing for years. Whether it's fantasy or if it's a fantastic story or whether it's gothic and, you know, does it fit into a fairy tale genre? There are all these ideas. It doesn't quite fit in the general sense. It's fantasy, which is why we cover it here, because we do cover fantasy as well as science fiction. People have also looked at it and said, well, maybe it's futuristic or post-apocalyptic in some future version of the world where most of the population has either died out or left the planet. Then you're left with these little groupings like Gormenghast. And I think it's partly because of that third book, Titus Alone, where Titus goes off to some other city that's never heard of Gormenghast, and Gormenghast has never heard of them, and they have this more advanced technology. So because of that phase in things, some people look at this whole story and say, well, it's a futuristic thing that has a retro-futuristic fairy tale kind of feel to it. So there are discussions and disputes as to where this fits in. Not being one to rely on categories all the time, I'll leave this without a firm categorization or genre.
Okay. I mean, it does, you know, as you say, it's an interesting discussion as to what actual genre this book and the adaptations fit into. But no, it's great fun. I think it works very well. And as you say, there is the hint that it may be post-apocalyptic. Okay, availability of the discs. It was released on DVD. It's a two-disc set, which is widely available, both in Region 1 and Region 2. There's some extras on the DVDs. There's a making-of documentary when you'll see a lot of this stuff about the design of the sets that we've talked about and the designs of the costumes, and also interviews with some of the actors, notably Stephen Fry is very amusing, and Christopher Lee is on there, I think, talking about the fact that he actually had met Mervyn Peake. He actually knew Mervyn Peake. So that's quite good. There is a slight spoiler warning that goes with the DVD set. I don't know if this is the same in the Region 1 version, but in the Region 2 version, there's a production booklet that comes with the DVD set. And we do try and avoid spoilers here on British Invaders. So my advice would be not to read that production booklet until after you've watched the DVDs, because it does contain some spoilers.
Now I feel shortchanged because my Region 1 copy did not come with a booklet.
Ah, right. Well, it may not exist in the Region 1. Ah, right.
At least not in every release of it. Maybe you can find it somewhere. But yes, it is easy to find that DVD set, and it's quite good. The novels as well are relatively easily available. You can certainly find the novels around.
The DVDs are available, and they're available on rental, but they're pretty cheap. It's for 1 hour episodes, so it's not a great, huge investment in time either. Which I guess brings us to recommendations. In our last two shows, we've sort of gone, there's been a split. We've sort of gone 50-50.
One thumb up, one thumb down, something like that.
Yes. So we'll see how we're going to go on this one. Brian.
Well, I really enjoyed Gormenghast. I enjoyed it when I first saw it in 2000, and I enjoyed watching it again now. It's a very well-made piece of television. It's worth owning. It's worth coming back and watching it every once in a while. So definitely a strong recommendation from me. This is a really fun one to watch.
And I don't think it's too much of a surprise to say that it's the same from myself. It's a thumbs up from me too. I really enjoyed this. I think it's a fantastic miniseries, and I think it's well worth watching. And I think if you've been put off slightly by the books and their difficult reputation, then this is a great introduction to Mervyn Peake, and it really will fill in the first two books for you. I think you just need to watch this. And once again, like other stuff we've talked about, it's not an enormous investment in time. It is just 4 hours rather than a very long, you know, several seasons or whatever. So I think it's a definite two thumbs up recommendation from us at British Invaders.
Absolutely. So, in summary, Gormenghast was a 2000 BBC TV miniseries based on the first two novels in a trilogy by Mervyn Peake. It was set in Castle Gormenghast, which was a large castle that was like a city-state in and of itself. And it began with the birth of Titus Groan, the heir to be the new Earl of Gormenghast, and also began with the rise of the evil and malevolent Steerpike, who rises from being a servant in the kitchens to higher and higher position. And it is a dark show with some pretty dramatic moments and a dramatic ending to finish it all off. How's that for a summary?
I think that's spot on. Yes, absolutely. Do check it out, and do, as ever, let us know what you think about Gormenghast, and if we've missed any important details of the books or the adaptation. Do let us know.
And you can do that by finding us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com and at www.BritishInvaders.com. Our next pair of episodes will be about Time Slip, the 1970 time travel show that was aimed at children, but very detailed and complex in its own right.
And it will feature a scary confession by me.
Well, we'll definitely look forward to that. But I think that covers it for Gormenghast. So this is Brian from Canada signing off.
And this is Eamon from England saying thanks for listening and goodbye until next time.